Hello, everybody. This is Jughead, and welcome to the show. I am so very happy that you are here, and I am sorry that it has been a couple weeks since my last episode. Things are a little bit busy here in Japan, but I am doing what I can to bring you quality material. And here, of course, is some quality material. I have had the D-Cracks on the show before, but they have a new release coming out very soon, and I think it's a pretty great little package of 28 songs. So we brought them back onto the show to talk about that and to talk about their friendship. I also plan to get their new bass player, Michael, onto the show. I think I'm interviewing him sometime next week. So I have a few things planned, upcoming. And, you know, as always, try to get to the Patreon and become a member here and donate to the show at the $2, $5, and $10 tiers. You get shit in the mail, maybe, and also you get unedited videos of all of the shows and brought to you before the at-home audience gets the audio dake. Dake means only in Japan. I just want to keep this one short, so do what you can. If you don't have the money to be a patron, then, you know, write some reviews or share the podcast with friends. Or you can do a one-time donation at PayPal. Just go to PayPal and pay it to jugheadsbasement@gmail.com. There it is. Let's go. Now you are listening to the re-recording of Another Time Bomb off of D-Crack's 20 Years A Frantic Effort to be released, if you are listening to this in the present tense, on November 17th, 2023. Hello everybody and welcome to Jughead's Basement, episode 185 of Lo-Fi Interviews with Hi-Fi Guests, this week with Matt and Mike of the D-Cracks, and we talk about their new record, 20 Years of Frantic Effort, its re-recording and its benefits, spontaneity and intention, Michael Marti, the new bass player, an in-depth discussion about the working and friend relationship between Mike and Matt, never chose to make it a lifetime, but here we are, our small town was never our universe, touring Russia and Japan, which punk rockers do not sweat, plus, much, much Cretan D-Crack Midra K and more! Baby, let's go! Hello to cool. Both of you. Look it, we're here, we are again.
Yes.
Yeah. How have you been? How's life?
It's been a rough week, but good. I mean, things are good here. It's beautiful here in the fall time, so I'm looking forward to some nice days. But yeah, this is the busiest time of the season here, so it's just that they have us working long hours.
Yeah. Where are you working at the moment?
At the Wizarding World of Harry Potter here. And
oh, still, yeah.
Again. Yeah, it's my ninth time again.
Yeah.
Yeah, last time we talked, I was in Florida, wasn't I? I think I was staying at Chris Barrow's house, right? Yeah.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, that's true, yeah.
Yeah. Well, some stuff has happened since then, so that's why we're here again.
Well, that was like 3 years ago. When was it? 4 years ago? Something.
John in the future here. The D-Cracks were on episode number 56, which came out March 3rd, 2021. So 2 years and 7 months.
So you boys are doing the rounds. I've seen a couple interviews with you.
You're
doing this this 20 year record and taking it pretty seriously, it seems.
Yes, absolutely.
Like always, just because we're drinking coffee and water at the moment doesn't mean we're taking this seriously.
No, but I mean, this isn't even something I wrote down, but I know you base it kind of on the songs that you've been playing live, you know. For those who don't know, they probably know, we'll talk more about this, but the new record is two new songs, but also all re-recorded songs from like the beginning of the band till now. I get the gist that what you did is that the energy that you started creating live and the better you got as musicians, you tried to recapture that in re-recording, which I think you did. I think they really sounds very tight. It's really well done. Really, I like these recordings a lot. They don't ring to me as re-recordings of something in the past. You know, it sounds pretty fresh.
Yeah, that was the intention. And also, you know, we wanted to have it a 20-year thing, so 2003 to 2023. And so there had to be two songs from 2023 on it. And then we wanted to have like a mutual sound. So everything, we wanted to have it like an actual record, not like a best of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
So everything is supposed to sound like an actual record. So the thought was if this would have been our only D-Crax record, if we would have written all these songs within 20 years and we only go to the studio now, this would be the record,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah. So the question I wanted to get to that I didn't even write down, but I just thought about when I just started talking was, you've been playing these live, so you're still familiar with them, but is there something about hearing them back in the studio that, I don't know, makes you contemplate them? Was there a strange feeling or realizations of those songs while you were hearing them again, like in the studio? It's a hard question I'm trying to get at, but is like, and you, like you as a writer, Matt, was there like reviewing like your life or these thoughts? Did any of that occur while you were recording these in the studio? Or was it just get in, record, get out? Was there sort of like a reliving of all of that?
Well, I don't know. There were some songs that I have to say, I wasn't too excited about re-recording them just because I've been playing them like a million times. But then on the other side, there were songs that I always thought, this always happens, you know, when you go to the studio, you get out and you hear it for the first time, whatever you record, there's always something you find that you could have done different, right? There's always, I wish I would have played it like that, or I wish I would have sang it like that. In the end, I was thinking, okay, I'm going to do this time. We tried to add some harmonies and some other guitar parts and stuff, but in the end, it was very close to the original, which made me think maybe the original is not that bad after all. And but yeah, there were some songs that I was happy to re-record, but not so much because of the content of the lyrics or whatsoever, more about the music and stuff. Because most of the songs that mean something to us or to me, we constantly play them anyway. So I didn't have to go all the way back and kind of remember
the time
when I wrote it for the first time, you know?
Mike, as a drummer, can you actually hear the progress you've made having like reviewed all those songs from the beginning till now and then?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Especially the very old ones, you know? Especially
yeah,
the
yeah.
old ones. There's this track called Another Time Bomb that was one of the songs that we actually wrote in 2003. And I started playing drums just the year before. So I actually started playing drums in 2002. And then, so of course, you know, playing them now is like, okay, I can finally hold this beat actually and, you know, not have the kick all over the place or, you know.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
The way we recorded this as a demo back in 2004 was, you know, totally different to how it sounds now. And this was quite interesting to go do these songs again and just, you know, be better at it, you know, especially at some. The songs we re-recorded from the past, like three records or so, weren't that, you know, there's not that much of a difference, but everything before, you know, I could really see that I can basically do a little more with it now, or at least play it a little more, you know, straight.
But even if I think, even the old songs, like the ones where we couldn't play, or we couldn't play as well as today, probably, they also have its charm, I guess, and they are still here. So if I want to listen to those, I can also listen to those. And it's just a new version that is a little more precise, of course.
Yeah.
But I think like older recordings, when even if they're a little bumpy or a little sloppy or whatever, this has a lot of charm also, you know.
Sure.
I mean, we all grew up listening to this kind of music also. And musicianship was never really a thing, you know?
Yeah.
Because it was kind of against what we were thinking, what we were supposed to do as a punk band.
And I have fond memories of like in the early years, where like all the recording sessions in out, to be honest. And you know, when I listen to the records, even the early recordings, I'm just happy with it because, you know, we had fun in the studio always, you know. So it's just cool to hear a song again and like properly made. You know, it's always been fun, you know.
Yeah, I want to talk about the recording too, but let me hash this out a little bit more, because it's really interesting to re-record that much of yourself over time. It's just, I like, for instance, did you because sometimes like magic is captured in a song, you know, like whether you're good musicians or not, you know, you record something and then you try to redo it. Like even Weasel, we tried to do stuff like that. And I always liked the originals better. But was there like in the studio wondering about that? Or did you, were there some that you're like, ah, this isn't as good?
Obviously, when you re-record something, it's less spontaneous, right?
Mm-hmm.
And especially the first recording with the first demo we did in 2003 was also a live recording. So we were all together. We recorded everything besides the vocals, of course. We did that after. But we had two guitars and bass and drums all recorded all together. And it was, we did like two or three takes each song, and we just took the one that was the most bearable, I have to say. And so, of course, it's a totally different thing. And we were also, you know, it was, we were staying at a friend's house who had the studio in the basement. We were there the entire weekend. So, of course, we were also always together, like partying. And then at some point, I remember at 4 a.m, they had a party at the house. There were several people living there. It was like a, not really a squad. It was more like a community thing.
Yeah.
And so we thought, let's get all the people in the studio and have them sing some gang vocals and stuff. You know, of course, this is very different than what we did now. You know, now we went to the studio and everything. Everybody had his parts learned and everything. Everybody prepared. So, of course, this is, and every studio recording that we did after in all these years has its different stories and its different spontaneous things. A lot of things happen spontaneously in the studio because there's always the main core of the song is prepared, but then you go in the studio and then you listen to the recording and say, oh, maybe you sing that here and you sing that there, or maybe I play this with the guitar here, or maybe you do this here with the drums. You know, a lot of things happen in the studio, of course. So the re-recording was, of course, different in a sense that the song was already, did already exist. But again, for a lot of songs, we were now for the old songs again in the studio. And we also thought, oh, wait a second, here we could do this harmony, here we could do this part, and you know. But the sense of the spontaneous things that happen in the studio, they are always different, of course. You know, the first time in the studio is, of course, the most precious one, the precious memory, because everything is new, sort of, right?
Yeah.
And you're used to play the songs live or in the practice room, and all of a sudden you have to be, especially when you record live, all of a sudden you have to be as precise as possible. And then, you know, you listen back and you find out, oh, okay, I didn't play that. It doesn't really sound like, in reality, it doesn't sound like it does in my head. So, you know, but over the years, you get a little experience with that, and we got better in recording, I have to say.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I mean, I've known you guys probably a long part of your career, but I've been, you know, I've listened to all the records, and there's definitely an increase in like energy, and like how you guys capture the energy has seemed to finesse itself. Like, it's gotten better and better. Like the way, and I think in YouTube, I've been working with others so long that the way the instruments line up are very nice too. And your backing vocals, Mike, to Matt is very clear and very strong too.
Thanks.
So yeah, I was very impressed.
But
with
also
it.
a lot of credits would go to our sound engineer Marco.
Yeah. I wanted to get into that. So let's do it. So where was this recorded?
We recorded this in our original hometown, Klagenfurt, Austria, south of Austria.
Yeah,
Pegel Music Studios.
More specifics here. We are talking about Marco Lino, last name might be pronounced Perdacher, and his studio is called Pegel Music, P-E-G-E-L, Music.
Forgive me for not having studied this part of it, but I have done some other studying. Have you recorded there before?
We did the last record in the same studio.
That's right. Yeah.
The last two.
Yes.
Yeah, the last two records. That's true. Sorry.
Plus a lot of other, you know, like EP stuff and compilation stuff. I think since 2015, we were in this studio. If I'm not wrong.
Yeah, but I mean the name was different 2 years ago because
they changed it. Every
Marco has a habit of, you know, switching studios or switching names of studios. You know?
Yeah.
So we always record with him no matter where the studio is or you know what's it called. You know, we don't care. We want him to, you know, produce it.
Yeah. So that's I think I remember you talking about it now. He was from your where you guys grew up, and you're a small town. Since you guys recorded there, have you brought like other bands there? Like has your notoriety to whatever level you are, have other bands recorded there based on your suggestions or anything?
A few, not many, but 7 Years Bad Luck from Austria recorded with him in the same studio. And there's other people, bands like the 20 Belows from Denmark. They had their record mixed and mastered by him. Looking at the door with a goodbye and a kiss. I'm sure we had a blast. I've forgotten most of it. See, my memory is gone. My body says I'm old. I'm telling you tonight, I'm staying home. Yeah, he had some different bands approaching him, mostly for mixing and mastering, because, you know, the studio is, you know, nobody really, not many bands find their way to Austria to record, you know.
Yeah, so, yeah.
So they record by themselves, or you know, with some other guy, and then they have it mixed or mastered by Marco.
And I did the. I have another band. I play another band called Jagger Holly.
Oh, yeah.
And we did the last record also there.
Oh Marco. Yeah, that's right. Jagger Holly. And was the new Michael on this recording? Is he?
Yes.
Yeah. It was the first recordings we did with him. And it was probably cool for him also to record all those songs that most of the songs we actually, yeah, you know, play live already. So it's not like, you know, all new stuff. But yeah, now he made it his own songs, basically. You know, he recorded them. And yeah, that's his first official release with us. And we can't be more happy.
Yeah, that has, I mean, I guess to be a new, I mean, you've known the guy for a long time, but to be, yeah, to join a band, who else did this? Oh, it was Chuka with Teenage Bottle Rocket, where he came in on a cover record, like all the songs. Yeah. So it's kind of an interesting way to come into a band, is to have those songs already recorded in some way. And so you can actually sit home and play to them. And then there must be a little hesitation as to bring in your own style or not. And I don't know if those songs allowed for a lot of, he came in on bass, right? He's a guitarist, but
he came in on bass. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But also, I mean, we could tell that in the studio, he really wanted to like leave a mark on those songs, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe not so much on the bass playing part, but more like vocally, you know. I try to be like do more backings, you know, more harmonies to Matthias or me, or you know. Oh,
that's so nice.
And there's some pretty good stuff that he came up with, and that really is also what made the songs a little different to the first recordings we had of all of them, you know.
I'm definitely going to have him on. You and I, Mike, talked about having him on, and I'm pretty excited about it now. So it's nice that we talk about him a little bit. So how did that line up to bring him in?
Well, I mean, I've been playing music with him for the past 7 years, actually, because I was drumming for his Swiss band, Midrig. Somebody said you are not. So that's how they were also on Monster Zero Records, and so they asked me to replace their drummer for like a couple of shows. So that's how I met him in the first place. Then he ended up being the bass player for the Isotopes, this Canadian punk band that I played drums for on all the European tours, and
yeah,
he did like half a European tour. So we were in this band together all of a sudden, and then we played with Joe McMahon and in Smoke or Fire, like an American band. You know, we ended up in various different projects, and this is our sixth band together, I think. Yeah.
Six. Yeah.
Really? Yeah, I think so. I don't know. Or maybe fifth. Yeah.
I think I actually asked him at the Raduno a couple of years ago, like 5 a.m. I asked him if he wants to. You know, the next day I woke up, I was like, what have I done?
Is he the one that has the guitar shop in the Raduna? Oh, okay. Okay. So I've corresponded with him a couple times before.
Yeah. Great. Lovely guy. You know, people know him and he's well respected. He's a good musician. And, you know, we know him and we know touring with him. So he was a good fit, you know, besides the distance, because he lives in Bern, Switzerland, which is, that's like a day drive, you know, that's like a 10-hour drive or something. So, or like a very expensive flight in Swiss prices, you know?
Yeah. So you have some stuff coming up. You have your 20th anniversary shows in November, and then you're coming here to Japan right after.
Yeah. Yeah.
So is it going to be a whirlwind sort of him fly in or drive in and rehearse and then go, or what's the plan?
Well, we don't really rehearse. so we basically meet at some shows, you know. We just like 3 weeks ago, I think it was like early October, we played a show in Graz, in a town in Austria. And he flew from Switzerland to Graz, and he got there like 5 minutes before we had to get on, you know. We were like, come on, you know, the flight was late, you know. And so he came in. I'm like, hey, how are you doing? How was the flight? Cool. All right, let's go play. So that stuff happens now, but it's fine.
Yeah. I guess having all those recordings, like you said, that y'all redid of all the songs you play over the years, kind of helps too. Just plays along to that probably.
But we've done this kind of stuff with all of our older bass players. You know, we never really rehearsed, and we just, you know, try to play many shows, and maybe like a show or two if we haven't played in a while before that show was a little bit, you know, wobbly at times on a few songs. But, you know,
now I'm going to when we get back to, I'm going to get back to the new record and the tours, but let me I want to go now to about you guys, and then I'll return at the end about the two new songs. I do want to talk about the two new songs, but let's reach back now, because as I was reviewing your stuff, and Mike, as you we talked about you being on the show again, I was like, I want to do approach this where, I don't know, I'm always trying to find something new, you know, for the show, something the reason to have people back on. And just the fact that I love you guys is not always the best reason just to put someone on again. But I do think your relationship as friends and bandmates is worth people knowing about. It seems interesting to me too that you two are very close, and you've gone through a lot of bass players. So I guess one of my questions is there a bond between you two that you can't get another third to be in? Or is there, like, this band is more important to you guys than other people? Or is it, do you know what I'm trying to get at? Like, why is it just you two?
I think it's the lifestyle that we chose to have this band. You know, not everyone can, you know, make the time that we want to spend for this band. So to us, it was always important to get out of our, you know, back then it's of our little hometown. Now it's time to get out of Vienna, you know, and see the world and travel as a band and play as much as we can. And because we always felt that maybe this band has a limited time, you know, and then now we're 20 years in, but, you know, you never know. So, you know, we always had this drive to do as much as possible at all times, you know. So many of our bass players couldn't really make the time, you know. This was and totally we're totally okay with every single decision there, you know. Mostly because of their jobs or you know, life's other problems, you know.
I mean, yeah, that's why I was trying to, before you speak, Matt, which I do, you want you to, but I just wanted to say that with asking that question, I did want to state that it didn't seem like a point of controversy or conflict. It just seemed a situation that you two had that made it somehow more difficult or more dedicated because of the relationship to the band or something that. But I know for a fact that, like, Paul, I think Paul is great, and I know that you guys are, you know, love Paul too. So it's not like,
yeah, of course,
it's not like you piss off bass players; they never want to talk to you again. But I mean, there might be some of that sometimes.
You know, You know, the thing is that since we're what happened was with now we're together for 20 years, that was of course never planned. We were never saying, okay, let's make this a lifetime. You know, the thing was we started this as a four piece with two of our friends. And then there was always something coming. You know that how it is in a band. Then there's always an offer here or there's something there. And then say, okay, here's some new songs. Let's go record them. Do this, do this, this, do this. And then it's always planned ahead. You know, it's like, okay, in January, you already know that maybe in September, you go on a European tour or something like that. And we were maybe more committed than others. And others were saying, yeah, but, you know, I can't. I have this job. Some started a family or stuff. And we were like, okay, if you don't want to, we're not gonna break up now, because we had this for 20 years, but we never took a break. You know, we never broke up in between, or we never went on hiatus or anything. So we always then found somebody else just to do it. And sometimes it worked and sometimes it just didn't. Sometimes it was a bummer that the person left because we kind of wanted, and sometimes it was a relief. Also, I gotta say, you know,
yeah,
because you can tell when you have somebody in a band that is not really fully there. But I think that's in every work, let's call it work relationships, like that. When you work together with somebody who is only doing the bare minimum and you are giving everything, at some point you're gonna say, wait a second, you know, I don't know, is this the way it's supposed to work? So, and of course we were then maybe more motivated than others, than some other bass players, but I think that's life. I mean, what about your band? How many members did you have? 800?
Well, yeah, well, Screeching Weasel did, but that was one of my goals with Even and Blackouts, was to try to build a family. And it took a few members, like, to before I reached the, you know, Gub, Liz, Bice, John, and or Phil incarnation. But yeah, and it was tough. It was tough to do that. And then now it's almost impossible, you know, like the older you get, families start forming, and there's less likelihood of financial compensation, it gets even more and more difficult to pull off.
But I also wanted to add, like, we actually only had like four or five like actual bass players, I would say. You know, there was a lot of stand-ins, of course, way more stand-ins that we had, you know, just for like one tour. In this like 7.5 years that Paul was in the band, you know, we had Eric Mankey from the Jetty Boys play bass on the European tour because he couldn't make the time. We had Lucy from the Spazzies, you know, come in like a 2-week European run. We had Jung, our Chinese bass player, play the China tour with us.
Yeah.
You know, so it was good because, you know, he could translate as well. So we wouldn't have found out our way out of the airport.
Yeah. No, I'm glad you clarified that, Mike, because I was going to mention that because looking at your Discogs things, there's the members, the bass players that are on it are just like, yeah, like I say, like four or five, but there's an article where you guys are talking about, or someone is talking about 10, 11, you know, bass players over time, but
yeah, Yemen is number 11. Yeah. So one more for the dozen, you know.
But Matt, to get a little bit back to you, because as you threw that back in my yard about Weasel, I agree with you. And it's kind of funny because I was just going to throw another question at you about that, because I had this interview with John Haggerty from Naked Ray Gun, and he'd said something to me that I was a little surprised at, but ultimately not really, because, you know, him and Jeff Pizzotti were like in the band from near the beginning, all the best records, they were together. And I ultimately said to them, were you two friends? Like, were you ever friends? And he was honest with me and said, no, he doesn't think they were ever really friends. They were bandmates, but never friends. So it did make me think about that. And that's, I wrote a whole book about Weasels in a Box, which is about me trying to decide whether Ben and I are friends or not. And it's, you know, it's still out to whether we were or not. But I think it's an interesting thing to think about in band dynamics. I would say, yes, you two are friends, but would you say that you're friends? Like, are you friends before bandmates, or bandmates equally as friends, or what's your dynamic, do you think?
We were friends before we started the band. That's a fact. But of course, a friendship over 20 years, when you spend a lot of time together, it turns a little bit also into a little bit like a marriage, I got to say, right? Mm, and then you think you're going to also work with your wife. So it causes a lot of tension at some point, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So after, let's say you spend 6-8 weeks together, and also the way we travel, we still travel the same way as we did 15 years ago. You know, there's not much. Sometimes we get a hotel, never get a single room, of course. So you're really 24/7, always together. And of course you need some time out after that. It's not that we come home from a tour and then we say, okay, let's go to a show. Let's go for a beer, or let's go for dinner the night after or something, you know? But there is a friendship, of course, because otherwise if you can't stand the person, you know, I could also just leave any second. You know, I don't have to do this. You know, it's not that I have signed a contract or anything.
Yeah.
But maybe of course when you're younger, the friendship is in any ways different. And you know, and when you're friends for 20 years, I don't think you're the same kind of friends as you are 20 years ago or 25 years ago in this case, even. Right? I mean, I think so.
Yeah, no, I agree.
There's a mix between bandmate and friendship, of course. And the band is always circles back a topic whenever we talk. It's mostly about the band, of course, but there's also other things, you know. I mean, there's a lot of memories we share, and there's a lot of jokes that only we can understand. There's a certain dynamic. Sometimes, of course, you fight because you just, you know, but that's just the thing, you know. I mean, when you're that close, sometimes a stupid little thing can just blow the lid off, right? Just like somebody does something, weird noise in the van that just pisses you off, you know, that usually you would not even bother. And of course, also the other thing is, the older you get, the more you want to be a little bit more, not really independent, but you need a little bit more space, I guess. You know, when you're 25 and you tour, you're fine with being together with your bandmates and friends all together all the time. You just hang out, you go for drinks after the show, you know, all this. But when you get a little older, you know, 44, like in my case, you also need a little bit of privacy also when you travel, right? So you would love to have a little time for yourself when you tour and stuff. But that doesn't mean you just hate the other person just because you don't want him around all the time. So as I said, the whole thing started as a friendship. And, you know, it probably changed, but I would still say we were friends, of course. Yeah.
Yeah.
We never really had the feeling that somebody doesn't have the other guy's back, you know, on anything in those 20 years, I wouldn't say. But of course, you know, there was always like frustrating times with each other and, you know, loving and fun times, you know, but that's just how relationships work, you know. But I don't know, the music always kept us together for sure. And the fun also. So, you know, and all the adventures we did.
In an interview you just did, Mike, I heard you talk about looking up to Matt a little bit because you thought he was a good guitarist and you weren't even playing yet at that time.
Yeah. In the beginning, yeah. I was you know, frightened, you know, to actually have a band. Oh my God, I'm having a band, you know? Yeah. So, cause I just started playing drums for real, like a year before. And then I just wanted to play one show. And then, you know, this became a thing and we started the band. And every single one in this band, we were a four piece when we started out, because Marco, the guy we're producing, was actually our second guitar player in the beginning, and Manu, our original bass player. So those four, and I mean, the other three, they all had bands for like 5-6 years, you know, and I was with them for, I mean, I'm younger than them, but I was with them, you know, doing their merch, you know, I don't know, taking care of their websites, you know, whatever I could do to help him, or setting up shows, or, you know, doing stuff. So I always wanted to be around bands, but then all of a sudden I had my own. I was terrified, you know, going on stage and playing, and they all know what they're doing, and I don't know what I'm doing, you know. So
nobody knew what he was doing.
Yeah, but then I found out nobody knew what they were doing. they had me fooled all these years.
Just because they were older, you thought they knew what they were doing or something.
Yeah, well, you know,
yeah.
Like I was a kid, basically. I mean, I was just 18 when we started the band, and I hung out with them. You know, Matthias, he's and my older brother, they used to, you know, beat me up in my house, you know, and lock me in the closet and stuff like that when I was like, whatever, 12 or something, you know, and now, because I mean, I was the annoying little brother kid, you know, so I get it.
But when do you, I don't know. When did it go from being that little the younger brother locked in a closet to being like an equal with them? Did you feel like you had to grow into that, or did you pretty much have confidence with yourself?
I always had confidence. That's why I was the annoying little brother. You know, I didn't really back down from them or so. You know, I always like went into my brother's room when they were hanging out there. You know, or you know, followed them around, or you know, just I wanted to hang with them all the time. Yeah, you know, yeah. But even though this meant getting beat up most of the time, or you know, just being yelled at or whatever, and you know, made fun of. But I don't know how it actually how I grew into their bubble, you know.
Yeah.
But it took some time, of course. You know, when I was like growing up, when I was like 14, 15, I think I started, you know, joining them for, you know, trips. My brother took me to a show. Then I met everyone, you know, in a different environment than our home.
Yeah.
So, you know, and then they saw me drink beer and all that stuff. And they were like, hey, that's a cool little kid. I don't know how it went. You have to tell me, actually.
I don't know. I mean, it might be an unanswerable question, but was there a moment, Matt, where he went from your friend's younger brother to, hey, like, hey, this guy's actually kind of cool, or he could be my friend too? Or was that even a thing?
Yeah, yes. But I can't really pinpoint the moment. But there was we had this kind of hangout bar in our hometown where we always went almost every night we were there. I was living almost right next door, actually. So I was really almost like always there. We did shows there. We could listen to the music that we liked there, because they would let us play whatever we want. And we were all hanging out there, and we just started talking. And I, you know, at the time when I was playing in a band with his brother, and in this case, the music interest, the preferences, and the way we wanted to have the band was different than his brother's. So I could see more similarities with when I talk about music and stuff with him. So I started to talk more with him, and at some point, I can't remember exactly when, but he didn't feel like the younger brother then anymore. Yeah. Or the little kid.
I think it was our summer of love was the summer of 2001, I think, because that's when we were just, you know, I was starting to like skip school anyways. And, you know, I was, you know, failing school. I had to like, you know, I don't know. I was just a brat, you know, mm-hmm. And so we hung out all summer because he was already living in Vienna at the time. But then he came down in summer for like 2 months. And we went to this bar that he was talking about like every day, you know. It opened up at 5 and we were the ones like there. You know?
Yeah.
And then we just hung out and drank and talked about The Simpsons and New York City and the Ramones or whatever, you know. And and we did this like every day for like the whole summer. At least that's what I remember.
Yeah, I mean, it could be that year.
I think so. And I was 16. I just turned 16 there.
Wow.
Yeah, it was. At this point, I think that age, it wasn't like that. How old was I then? 2001, I was 20, 22. So like, it wasn't like, it didn't feel like I'm talking to a little kid.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
So it was just, age wasn't really any matter there. You know, it was just, we shared same interests, and that was, we could have fun and we could talk, right? And we had a lot of friends in common also, you know, so that was, we were always like a big round of people. And there was always, as I said, at this place, we were friends there with everybody, with the owner, from the owners to, it was a little bit like a living room.
Yeah. The name of the bar was called Barfly. And it was like the only alternative music place really, you know, in town. So, I mean, we all just started to have cell phones back in those days, but we never needed them because, you know, everybody was just there. Everybody was going there every Friday and Saturday. So you started calling people up when they're not there, you know? Yeah. So you're like, hey, where are you today? Like, you know. So that was the kind of place. And it was all the bands that were, everyone that was into music basically, you know, more than just listening to it, you know, also playing. They were all at this bar. So that was our hangout spot, and that's where it all happened.
Do you, you can both answer this separately. Do you still, I've been thinking a lot about home lately, especially living in Japan, but do you, what is home to you? And do you still consider that place where you grew up home, or have you made like Vienna your home now? I mean, that's a question for both of you.
In my case, I think I live in Vienna now longer than I ever lived in our hometown.
Yeah.
And I feel more at home here in Vienna, I have to say. I mean, when I go back home, even though everything is still, a lot of things, of course, this bar, for example, doesn't exist anymore. And it still looks the same, but it feels different, right? Because you see it with different eyes. You know, I mean, I've been a lot of places all over the world. When I was 16 and we started our bands in Klagenfurt, it was necessary because the city was and still is not on the map for bands or promoters or booking agencies. Nobody came. So we had to do our own scene. You know, we had to start our own music. And there was, at the time, you know, in the mid-90s, there was a lot going on there. But, you know, all the kids, there were the hardcore bands, there were punk bands, metal bands, crossover, everything. So this was our universe, sort of. Mm-hmm. And of course, it looked different. It also looked much bigger, I have to say. When I was 16, the city was, it always felt small, and it kind of cuts off your oxygen because you feel so tight there.
Mm-hmm.
But it still felt kind of cool what we created. And then once we left, and when you come back, it just kind of feels different. You know, now I look at it, and of course, when I look at certain places, I have memories about it, but they are super far away, in my case, at least.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't know if I really feel like home there.
Yeah, yeah.
I have both. I mean, I love Vienna. I love living here. Like, this is what I consider my home, because this is where I've built everything in the past 18 years since I'm living here. And but my hometown, you know, I still have my parents there, of course, and my grandma, and, you know, a lot of friends there. So when I go to Klagenfurt, it's not like you know, I have no feelings for the city. You know, I'm also a huge hockey enthusiast, and, you know, my hometown team will forever be Klagenfurt. You know, so, yeah. You know, I can't root for the Vienna team. You know,
yeah.
This will never happen. And so I have that, and the beautiful lake that's in Klagenfurt. You know, that's stuff that I love about the place. You know, but of course, when I go down there, I'm also a little lost, like Matthias. You know, we can't really. There's not much to do anymore for us. I mean, you know, it has nothing to offer. The bar is closed. You know, and this was our safe haven. This one little place where we just go, and everybody was there. You know, so now nobody's nowhere. You know, and it feels like the time is standing still. But not the good time, you know?
I mean, you know, it's a typical small town, or maybe universal, maybe it's like everywhere in the world it's the same. It's a typical small town where you have to fight extra hard if you do something different than, let's call it, the mainstream, you know, when you listen to different music or you dress in a different way. Because the people, most people are very, I don't know, let's say small-minded, you know, they're very narrow-minded. I, for myself, when I was a teenager, I couldn't wait to get out of there. I really hated it, because there was always problems. You know, there was always problems with some, let's call them normal people, as they would call themselves, probably, mm-hmm. right? So, you know, when you do a show, when you're a teenager and it has to be over, let's say at 10:30, and if it's not over at 10:30 sharp, somebody would have already called the cops. Some neighbor would have, you know, they would have already been there and said, "What's going on here? What's going on here?" Then the same kind of people would argue about that nothing's ever happening in their city, right? Yeah, it's so boring here, nothing's ever happening. Then something's happening, but it's not what they want to happen, because the people might not look like what they expect the people to look like, or maybe it's too loud or whatsoever. You know, there's this two sides. It's this typical mindset, you know? Nothing's ever happening, but if something's happening, it's not the right thing that happens. This has to be different.
Yeah, it's the grass is always greener on the other side, sort of thing. Yeah.
And I couldn't wait to get out of there, honestly, you know? Obviously, then for me, there was only one option, and Vienna is the biggest city in Austria, and I wanted to be here because I wanted to meet some, you know, also like-minded people, you know, share music. And I also wanted to go see bands, and that was my main interest.
And have an international airport to go travel
also.
Yeah, that's pretty handy. I think I just realized through this conversation, guys, that part of my obsession with home does have to do a little bit with the idea of personalities that want to expand outside of their circle. You know, like there's a natural instinct to want to be curious of the other or the outside. Because I mean, when I lived in the suburbs, I was quite content living in Mount Prospect. But then when my friend moved and I moved into the city, everyone was like, oh, you've always been like a city guy. You should have been there, you know, a long time ago. And then I started analyzing and then, oh, that's right. Yeah. There was something small about my suburb that really didn't match with how I felt to be in the world.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And then once I went to Chicago, then it expanded outwards and outwards and outwards, you know, to building a community all over the world, which I think is for a lot of us a goal.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
At the time, I think it was even more exciting because you really didn't know what to expect because there was no internet, right? So when we were saying, let's, for the first time, let's try to play a show somewhere else, I had no idea how it's going to be like. You know, now
let's
you
get the map.
Yeah, now you can, but also now you can look up the place, you can, you know, you can check out the bands that you play with and all this stuff. You know, you already know. You know, I can look, if I say, for example, I play a show in Tokyo in a month, I can go on the internet and look up the venue. And so I already know how it looks like. I can look at pictures and stuff. Right? Yeah.
You can use Google Translate to translate the language.
Yeah, awesome. Hello.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, and for the fact that when we grew up in this small town, the fact that no band was coming to play, we had to play this music that we wanted to listen to, actually, right? And we wanted to other people also to listen to the music that we are listening, but that was the only way. You know, we had like one or two record stores that had, sometimes later on when we became friends with them, they would give us the records. They would order records. So I also, like, I think I got my first Weasel CD from the guy because he ordered it, but nobody would buy it. So he would tell me, just take it because nobody's going to buy this anyways.
Which one was it?
So I got it. I think it was Kill the Musicians. Mm-hmm. So I got it for free.
Nice.
But a lot of other stuff too, right? And but it was impossible to ever see this kind of bands, you know. So and when you're 16, even a 2-hour train ride, because remember in Austria there's no such thing with cars when you're a teenager, so you had to depend on a train. And then even 2 hours or 3 hours, 4 hours by train somewhere to go see a show, it seemed to be not possible. It seemed to be impossible, because then you also, what are you going to do? Then you have to stay there all night and take the first train back in. We did that a lot, you know, like take a train, then go to a show, then spend the night somewhere and take the first train back home. You know, but of course it's a little exhausting, especially when you're 16, 17 years old and, you know, you have no idea what you're doing. But that was the only chance, you know, to do it, because there was no money. There was the option to go to get a room somewhere. It didn't even pop up.
Yeah. I wanted to jump back just to fill in a little bit for the people that may not listen to the other podcast that we did talk about. Your brother was mentioned a bit, but he is still sort of in the loop. I mean, he's your brother, but you two are also in that hockey band too together, right?
Yeah.
And I saw him. He played in that band. He played in the band that opened. We went to go see him the next night or the first night it came in, right? Your brother was playing.
Did we go see Candy Beat Camp? Yes. Like his
yeah, yes, project. We did. Yeah. Okay. So I just wanted the audience to know that he's still like in the loop of you guys, works with you guys, and he's still in bands and stuff.
Yeah. And I have a Weezer cover band with him now.
Oh, do you?
Yeah. Well, it was something that another friend of ours wanted to do with my brother and myself for a decade already, because we're Weezer fans. And then during the pandemic, the lockdowns, you know, he finally got us to like meet in the practice room and, you know, go through Blue Album and Pinkerton and, you know, then we learned them. And so now we actually already played 3 shows with this cover band also, just for fun, you know. It's cool though.
So between the two of you, how many bands are you playing with right now?
I don't know. Way too many.
I play in 3, but the other 2 are not really active, I have to say.
Yeah.
Because very, very spread. It's like Jagger Holly and the Redcliffs, which is a band with Paul, our old bass player.
Yeah.
It's a little spread out, everything, you know, so it's very hard to organize, ever to get together, ever to play shows. let's see, maybe next year we can do something.
The one I know the most is Jagger Holly. How is your relationship in that band different from this one? Like, do you have the same position in the band, or are you mostly a writer there too?
For the last record, we split the writing, but it was for the first time, and I think it's going to be a one-off thing. So we made the last record was a double record, and we made one. Actually, the intention was to make one record my songs and one record the songs of Jay, which is the main songwriter, and it's actually his band. So, but usually I'm just a guitar player, which I actually prefer because for some reason, I never wanted to be the singer in a band. I just always got into it. And it always turned out that I'm going to do it. I always wanted to be a guitar player, actually. I always thought it was much cooler. Maybe do a little backing vocals, but be just a guitar player. But that's what I basically am in Jagger Holly and in the Ratcliffs also.
Do you, Matt, actually consider yourself like a writer, or you're just someone that has to put in words for a song? Like, would you, at the end of the day, would you be a writer if you still didn't have music?
Yeah, I have to say, in the beginning, no. In the beginning, it was really just, let's make a song and let's just put some words together that may be funny, or maybe later on, sometimes they made actually sense, you know? But yeah, over the years, this kind of evolved, and I put more thoughts into lyrics. For me, it got more and more important that the song, in the first place, has a meaning to me. And I think that sometimes I hope at least that it's relatable to other people, you know, because I mostly write about myself or about things that I think are common problems, let's say. I mostly write about personal issues that I think that a lot of people might have, like, you know, like a topic that I always, for some reason, circle back to is the fact that you're being stuck in a rut and you're trying to think to, you know, to break out of this everyday routine that you have, and that you feel like that there's something more to your own life than you actually think you deserve, right? So this is a topic that I always circle back to, especially the lyrics that I wrote in the lockdown, you know, when you were stuck at home. This is something that I feel like a lot of people can probably relate to, it because a lot of people probably get up in the morning and do their thing, and at the end of the day, they're asking us, what am I doing today? You know, what have I done? You know?
Yeah, yeah.
Even though I actually have a life where there's a lot of things happening that not happen to other people, right? But yeah, I think if I wouldn't have, you mean if I would be a writer, like writing like literature stuff?
Yeah, I guess that it came out like that, and you sort of answered it like that. I wondered whether,
maybe,
like,
yeah, I know,
if you didn't have music, would you consider yourself be a writer? Now, it took me a long time to consider myself a writer. Like, I say I have to do something at least three times, like three records or three books, before I consider myself something. I had wondered whether writing for the band for 20 years, whether you started going, oh, I actually am a writer. I can say things with words.
Yes, but the main way to express myself, I have to say, is still the music, because the music is always first. It barely ever happens that I have lyrics and then I make a song to it. I actually think this is, for me, is very difficult. The other way around is much easier to me. So I come up, I always have like some hook line in the chorus or whatsoever. And around that, I make the music, and then you make the words to it. A lot of things has to do, of course, also with phrasing and, you know, how to pronounce or how to phrase the words so they come off a little more intense and then also fit the lyrics.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
Or fit the mood of the song, let's say, not fit the lyrics. But I don't know if my first approach would always be music. But if I would, for some reason, would say I don't want to touch a guitar anymore, I don't want to touch any instrument anymore, maybe I would consider writing something.
Mm-hmm.
But I imagine that very difficult, like writing an entire book or something. I mean, how long does it take? Like years? You know, I don't know.
Well, yeah, it does.
How long does it take for you usually from the idea?
Weasels in a Box took
product.
7 years. My other one took four. Yeah. And then the one I'm working on now, I'm on like 6 years right now. So,
yeah. So, wow.
You know?
But it takes me a while. Yeah, I'm a little bit too eccentric about the words I choose. And it's kind of, it's like pulling
my
hair out.
It's very important, I guess.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I think I touched on this before, but I guess another topic that I'm always interested in, why I brought that up with you, Matt, is that I know you're writing in your second language. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yes. So I like, I think I even brought this up last time, but one of the playwrights that I like the most is Samuel Beckett. He wrote his most famous plays in French, even though it was his second language, because he thought it made him simplify what he was trying to say more than try to expand too quickly, like with his actual language.
Nothing to be done. I'm beginning to come round to that opinion. All my life, I've tried to put it from me, saying, Vladimir, be reasonable. You haven't yet tried everything. And I resumed the struggle.
Do you experience some sort of interesting way of, does that happen to you in any way? I mean, like, because you speak English almost every day, and you've grown up with it mostly. So it's not like a foreign language that just came to you. But do you find that there is a nice simplification in the way that you write with English?
I think so, yeah, 100%. Because, I mean, I grew up mostly on listening to English music anyways. You know, it has a certain vibe to me anyways. And I think it's much easier to express yourself in English. Maybe it's because if it would be my first, it would be German. First of all, there's a different tone and a different rhythm to it. But also, I think it would be much more difficult to write in German because you have to choose the words much more carefully, because you have to be, of course, brutally honest when you write something. Sometimes I wouldn't even know how to write this then in German, you know, to make it sound good and also to be authentic. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
It's easier to me, and I never actually considered to write it. When I was a teenager with my very first band in the mid-90s, we wrote some German songs, but those were mostly about people that we didn't like and girls that we couldn't get and in school, how much it sucks. And you know, there was no serious thing about it. There was no deep thought when I was 15 writing a song. There's a little bit of a hype now here in Germany, Austria, with German speaking musicians. Mostly it's indie rock, indie pop, but there are also punk bands, of course, from Germany. Some do it really good, I have to say, and you wouldn't want them to sing in English, and some are just horrible, especially the ones that are trying to the German bands that are trying to copy a little bit, let's say, the punk bands from America or from England, but do this in German. They don't come off as very, very authentic. They come off a little bit forced.
Yeah, I was going to say, it probably sounds forced. They're trying to fit like a circle into a box, or a box into a circle, you know, type of. Yeah.
It kind of sounds like they would like to sing in English, but they chose German because it's of course the market. There's a lot of people, especially younger people in Germany, that don't speak English well. You know, they like this. So, but it doesn't sound real to me, you know. So, and as for myself, I don't know. I think it wouldn't sound authentic enough if I would ever write a German song or something. So this comes more natural to me to write lyrics and sing in English.
This question is probably something you can't just pull out of your ass, but I'm wondering, because I'm curious. A long time ago in college, a friend of mine, she was German, and she actually quoted me a poem that sounded beautiful, and that actually changed my mind about how harsh I thought, you know, German language was. It can be harsh, but there is a way to make it poetic. I just didn't know if there are certain phrases or like lines of poets or writers that you actually have in mind that you actually think sound nice or beautiful.
Well, I don't know where your friend was from, but you know, you have to remember that we in Austria, we speak German, but with a very thick dialect. And it depends on the region. So if I would sing, I would always jump into this dialect. It would sound even worse. You know, it's like the Southern Austrian dialect. Maybe you can compare it with, like, I don't know, like Mississippi, maybe.
Yeah, we're from an outside corner of the whole like German.
It's a little bit like a
part, you know, we're close to Italy and Slovenia, you know. So
it's like redneck German.
Yeah.
You know?
So yeah. I'm going to keep you probably for like another 10 or 15 minutes, but I want to hit your relationship with Japan, because you're coming back again, which I'm happy because I will see you.
Yeah.
But let's talk a little bit about their relationship, because I've made friends with those people too, like Ness and the whole group, and Naoko and Chiba. So how did that originally happen, and how did it come to where it is now, where some of them are actually coming to your 20th anniversary?
Well, I mean, our first contact with Japanese, let's say, fans was actually on a UK tour that we did in 2011. There was, I'm not sure if you know Aisuke. He's also like a friend of that, you know,
I might have met him. I just don't know. I don't remember the name.
That's okay. But Aisuke and Akira, they were both living in London, and they were like traveling around to see us on like different stops on the UK tour. And so ironically, we named them Japan 1 and Japan 2 because we couldn't remember the name.
They also came to Italy once, I remember.
Yeah, they came to Italy once. And so those were the first real Japanese fans that we knew of, that we got to know. And so they wanted us to come to Japan. And we were like, of course we got to go to Japan, you know? But yeah, and then so they got us in contact with these, with Nas and Chiba. And 2 years later, was the first time we managed to go, you know? It was great. Mm-hmm. And we loved it there. And so we wanted to go. We never wanted to leave, first of all. And we can't wait to be back there.
It was very pleasant because it was a two-country tour. It was Russia and Japan.
Mm.
And it was like day and night, of course.
Wow.
For us, the Russian tour was fun, but it was very rough, of course.
Intense, you
know? It was really different than Japan. You know it yourself. In Japan, most of the places are very, you know, very clean, and the people are very polite.
Mm-hmm.
And everything works somehow. You know, in Russia, of course, they put everything together somehow. And there's a punk spirit there. The people want to do something, and they do it, of course, as limited as they are. They just put it somehow together, but it still works. But it's still very different than it is in Japan. So this first impression from Japan in 2013, for me at least, was already even more intense because I came from Russia. Maybe it would have been different if I would have come from Vienna straight.
Mm-hmm.
But it was already, you know, it was something... It was very impressive. You know, I remember I was super tired because we had a farewell party in Moscow the night before, which went till 7 in the morning. And we went straight to the airport and then fly straight from the airport in Tokyo straight to the venue and straight to the sound check.
Oh, man. You know? At the venue at this tiny thing.
I remember I was falling asleep, standing up, leaning to a wall. He was sleeping behind the merch table somewhere. Manu was not seen.
Yeah,
I think he was sleeping somewhere. He found another box or something. And then, of course, you see these bands, and the Japanese bands are very well prepared, and they practice like crazy. Yeah. And there's no, you know, there's everything is planned, so there's no mistake. And we were watching this, and we're like, okay,
the first band we actually ever saw there was the Kingons.
Yeah.
Oh yeah,
and those... like, how are we gonna keep up? We were like, that?
Yeah. All of a sudden, we were all back on back alive. That's it. We were all out there going like, holy shit, what the hell is happening here? So intense, you know, the way they were playing, we're like, oh my god. And then Soulja Pistons played after, we're like,
oh my
shit,
god,
what's
happening here?
go on, you know, like we are 10 days or 2 weeks into this tour, just coming from Russia, didn't sleep, you know, we're a mess. We're a complete mess.
Super dirty and sweaty.
Yeah, super dirty, sweaty, and just,
oh,
you know,
man. Yeah,
tired as hell. And then we got on stage and we played, and yeah, and it was great. It was at the Roots Club in Tokyo. Yeah, it was great memories. And then, wow, the tour began, and we just had the best of times with everyone, like every day. There was so many lovely people we've met, and yeah, the great food and the traveling and everything was so well organized, and we felt so welcomed and, you know, well taken care of. It was the easiest tour, and we expected it to be very difficult because of the language barrier, and you know, we can't read any signs or anything, you know, we're just, you know, we didn't know what to expect, of course, because it was our first time. So yeah, you know, we fell in love with Japan instantly there, you know.
Yeah,
but the thing is also, I think there's a mutual respect there, because we're not just going to Japan and take advantage of them inviting us, because we always tried also to bring them here, you know, mm-hmm, as many bands as possible, like the Kingons or the Social Pistons got invited also to
Oruduno, yeah,
but also before they were with the Apers ones. And I think they, not that they expect that, but of course they like it, because you know, it is a little bit like an exchange student exchange program,
cultural exchange program. Yeah.
So we bring them here, and we, you know, that's, I don't know if a lot of bands do that go to Japan and then afterwards also try to bring them here on tour. Also, I think that's also where they found a little more respect for us, since we always try to promote them here. And also now with the Kingons, we invited them to our show.
Yeah.
They come all the way from Japan for just the one show, just to play our 20th anniversary. And that's such a show of love and commitment. And we, yeah, can't be more happy and proud that that's actually, it's amazing that it's
happening. That audience is going to get a good surprise.
They don't know what they're in for, you know. We try to tell them, but of course we can't really describe what the Kingons are. You know, you have to experience it.
Yeah. I'll probably drop in one of their songs there, but even hearing their songs is not comparable to actually seeing them perform.
It's as if
they're playing in front of like thousands of people every show. Even if there's like 20 people in the audience, they're playing in front of 1,000.
I mean, we love them for it, you know.
Yeah. So I'm gonna now let's switch gears and because I got to bring it to an end for myself. But I did want to hit these two new songs, "Burnt Out" and "Where We Belong." Matt, did those come out of you knowing that you needed to do two new songs for this thing, or that were they songs you've been working on for a while, or how did they have any kind of themes in relation to what you were doing with the record already, or they're more spontaneous?
The song structure already existed for both songs, but I kind of finished them just for the record. There were a couple others also that I was considering, but these two seem to fit the best, because I wanted to, the one song that "Where We Belong" is a song that I made for my girlfriend, and the other song is like a little more like a punk song, and I wanted to have these two songs because these are mainly the D-Crex stuff, you know. There's these love songs, and then there's the punk songs,
or
the faster songs, let's call them. So, and I thought this would sum up the style that we do, and also the lyrical topic for the songs itself, right? But I kind of finished the songs just for the record, I have to say. A little structure was there already. And like, for example, the melody from the "Where We Belong" song, the verse melody, and which this is also then the solo and stuff, this was already there. But, you know, most of the time it's just like you start to play this when you pick up this fraction that you have, and you just play it through, and either it's fine. I like it actually when you write a song and you don't really have to change anything after. So we have this melody and you just sit down with the guitar, let some drum computer run, you figure out some BPM and you just play it, and either it's fine. I don't really like to then say, okay, this I have to change, this I have to change. Of course I do, if I feel like I have to. But in these two cases, I think it went pretty fast.
Yeah. And was there a decision not to do it like in, I don't think it's chronological because those two aren't even together. So how did you arrange the songs? Was there any much thought put into how you were going to?
Yeah. There was quite the process to get, you know, it's 28 songs.
So, yeah, you know, I know. Yeah.
You would try to create like a flow, but you don't want to have, we never wanted to have like two songs that were on the same record before, like right next to each other for once, you know, and all these kind of decisions, like little decisions to, you know, they don't have to like be in like the same style or, you know, start on the same chord or whatever and all that stuff, you know? So we tried to, everybody chimed in to get the set list going, the track list going.
Yeah, because I think what's neat about that too is it takes it even further away from being like a best of or something like that, because it's not done like chronological, like this is when we start and this is, it's like, here are these songs in this new formation. How do they fit together in their own unique way?
I mean, but that was the benefit. But that was the benefit of having it all re-recorded. So, you know, usually if we would have gone from like the sound that we had in the beginning to the sound that we have now, it had to be chronological. Logical, because otherwise it's like, oh, shitty sounding and great sounding. And you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, you know,
but it still it starts with a new song, but the second song is already one of the oldest, and it ends with a new song, and the very last song is also one of the oldest. So this is, of course, where the thing kind of the circle kind of closes.
Yeah.
And but in between, to arrange the songs so that it's a little bit of a flow and everything, that was a lot of work. But I think we managed it well. We were thinking first, we're thinking, okay, let's take the set list that we play, the main set list that we play for the last 1 or 2 years, and let's focus on that. But then again, there were some songs that were, as he said, on the same record. That's what we didn't want.
Yeah.
And but then also too similar, we didn't want. It took a while, I have to say, to get it done. But I think it turned out cool the way it is.
We also wanted to have like B-sides from like, you know, 7 inches or, you know, split releases that we had that were, you know, that deserved a little more attention, you know, some of those songs that we actually really liked, but they were never really, you know, on a proper record or, you know, well distributed, let's say.
Yeah.
So we chose them as well because, you know, some deep cuts in there is always good too, you know, for stuff like that.
Well, it's an impressive piece of work that you guys put together. So.
Oh, thank you.
I'm actually going to turn this around pretty quickly, so I'm actually going to get it out this week. So you might as well push the stuff you got going on just so people can pay attention. So what is the formats of the record, and where can people get it? It's out. And what, talk a little bit about this anniversary show, and then I think that, and if you got anything else.
The Japan tour, of course, you know, that's coming up. That's the closing of the year. And so the record is out on November 17th on Pirates Press Records, and it's a triple 10 inch in like two variants. It's a beautiful thing. Mm-hmm. And it's also coming out on CD on Dumb Records in Japan and Striped Music in Italy. So they're handling the CD release of it also on November 17th. And that's also the first day of our 20th anniversary festival at the arena in Vienna, our most favorite place here.
Yeah.
You've been there.
Yeah.
We have the King Guns come all the way from Japan for this festival. And Nikki Corvette is coming from Detroit, and she's playing with the Romeos, where Franz and Bruno playing, and Herve from the Pee-wees.
I think she's in Japan right now.
Yeah, she is.
Nikki Corvette is actually in Japan right now. Yeah.
Yeah, Misty just was one of her. What does she have? Like fruit jump on stage with her, like in costumes, like people in.
Oh
fruit
yeah, the
costumes.
Halloween ball stuff.
Yeah. Cool. I just saw a picture of that.
Yeah. And Neon Bohm from Germany are coming, and. We have the Yum Yums from Norway. They're coming to play the festival, and the Mugwumms, and Andrea Menges is coming.
Oh, great,
with the
great
veterans.
Yeah,
lots of bands, five bands each night, and DJs. And we're only playing Saturday on the November 18th as the last band, and we're playing the triple 10 inch in its entirety. And
wow,
and some more. A lot of work. Can't wait. No, it's gonna be fun. Like I can't wait for this to happen. Yeah.
Oh, that'd be like a whole nother meta level to actually release another record of your live show of the re-recordings of the original songs from 20 years.
Well, yeah. So that's it. And then a week later, we're leaving for Japan, and we have, I think, 8 shows in Japan lined up.
Seven. One is acoustic.
Yeah. Dumb Records. Yeah.
Dumb Records.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all still a show, maybe less sweating.
No. Remember the time they had to swipe the stage after we played?
Yes.
Yeah. That was in Japan. You know, none of the Japanese bands that played in leather jackets none of them were sweating. We were on stage dripping like crazy, and they were mopping the floor. Yeah,
they don't. It's like a stereotype, but they don't sweat very much here at all. It's really, embarrassing.
I know. But Hank never sweat also. Hank was one of those bass players.
Well, you know, Philip Hill doesn't sweat either. I don't understand it. He never takes his leather jacket off or his boots, but he does't sweat.
Are they like sleeping in saunas every night, or like what?
I don't know. Even on stage, when he's in full leather jacket and you know everything,
Cappy doesn't seem to sweat either.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Now that you mention it, I never really thought about that. But yes,
he's also wearing like a hat that's maybe.
Yeah, I mean, we just played some shows with him this summer, and he was always wearing his sweatshirt and the wool.
It's actually true.
It was like 40 degrees Celsius. It was sizzling hot inside. I remember, and he was just always fully dressed. And we were there.
That's so true.
He was like actually. You know,
maybe. He looks like a lizard a little bit.
And also B-Face. He was always wearing his jacket.
Yeah, that's true.
No matter which weather. He was like super hot, but he was just always wearing a jacket.
Oh, that's like, true. What's wrong with you? Well, maybe we're not as punk as they are.
Yeah.
I mean, Cappy is from Southern California. Isn't it hot there all the time?
Yeah. Maybe he's just used to this then.
Maybe.
Well, B-Face is on the other side of the world. He's in like Boston. It's always cold there.
So. It's always cold.
Sure.
Yeah. Boys, we have learned nothing about the sweat.
Yeah.
All right, guys. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jughead.
Thank you.
Good to see your faces. And when I say goodbye, it's a goodbye. So
bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Stop looking around. Too many shambles paved my way. Say that's right, but I've heard they never right. People that pass, they seem to be so far away. Contagiousness, signs taped on their back. With 6 a.m, the night's almost through, and are you out there too? Try and try to move on.
If you have made it this far, you just got done listening to Shambles, a re-recording of the D-Cracks on their forthcoming album, if you're in the present tense. If you're in the past, maybe it already came out. And it's called 20 Years, A Frantic Effort. If you get it on vinyl, it is 3 10-inch discs. So go to Pirate Press or look in the show notes and you'll be able to find some links to purchasing it for yourself. That's it, everybody. I really do appreciate you. Like I said before, I will have Michael, the new member on bass with the D-Cracks, for the next episode. And then I am also scheduling with Mac from Superchunk and also Damon, who is in Trenchmouth. So hopefully I'll get that done soon. So Go to the Patreon, become a member, donate to the show however you can, share episodes, and be happy, and take care of each other. Note to self, do and take my own advice. Goodbye, everybody.